We're checking in on a brain health supplement that is not strictly regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and what a nationwide class action settlement could mean for the supplement industry. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Prevagen is made by Madison-based Quincy Bioscience. They claim their supplement boosts cognitive function for aging adults.
Can a protein originally found in a jellyfish improve your memory? Our scientists say yes. Researchers have discovered a protein that actually supports healthier brain function. It's the breakthrough in a supplement called Prevagen.
Have you taken Prevagen? What attracted you to the supplement? Did it help your memory or did you not notice? We're at 800-642-1234. Kiara Eisner is an investigative journalist. Her recent piece in Wired is called Americans Took Prevagen for Years as the FDA Questioned Its Safety. Kiara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, give us a thumbnail sketch, if you would, of what Prevagen claims to be.
Sure. So Prevagen hit the market in 2007. And since then, the founder has been claiming that Prevagen can help Alzheimer's disease, it can help people with dementia, and basically improve memory loss, which is something that up until now, there is no actual cure for. There have been over 100 clinical trials trying to find a medicine that can cure Alzheimer's and can cure dementia, but there's nothing that's been approved by the FDA for this. So I think this has been trying to fill in that hole and really market to people who are aging and who are desperate for a cure for memory loss.
What types of trials or studies have been done over the past 13 years this has been on the market for Prevagen?
Yeah, so Prevagen, there's been one study that was done in the late 2010s, around that time in Madison. It was called the Madison Memory Study. And they got some local people, just over 200, to participate. But the results of the study have been questioned by the FTC, who's been suing Quincy Bioscience, which is the company that makes Prevagen. They say that the company basically cherry-picked from the results, and the company itself admits that there was no statistically significant result from the whole sample showing that Prevagen is effective when compared with the placebo. And yet, in its advertisements, it claims that it's been clinically tested and clinically proven and uses this kind of language to market it.
Was the study funded by the company itself?
It was. It was funded by the company itself, and it was published in a quote-unquote peer-reviewed journal, which, you know, I found out the editor-in-chief, his medical license was suspended. And in fact, the company had a history of advertising with the journal itself. I ordered a version of the physical copy that the research was published in. And if you open the front page, the back of the very edition that the research was published in has a full page ad for Prevagen. So
wow.
There is clear conflict of interest there. Nowhere in the whole research that was published in 2016 in that edition is conflict of interest mentioned or any kind of bias mentioned, even though Mark Underwood, who is one of the co-founders and is from Wisconsin, was one of the authors of the study.
Well, explain a little bit about who this Mark Underwood is and how he developed Prevagen.
So Mark Underwood was raised close to Mosinee and graduated from high school there. He then studied in University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where he got a Bachelor's of Arts in Psychology, though he claims in the advertising to have studied neuroscience and be a neuroscientist, sometimes he says too. And he founded the company in 2007 with his co-founder, Mike Beeman, and they've been running it together ever since from Madison.
We're talking with reporter Kiara Eisner about her piece in Wired on the claims of the supplement Prevagen and how the FDA has responded to it. Have you ever taken Prevagen? What attracted you to the supplement? Did it have side effects? Did you feel or have any memory improvements with taking it? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your experience. Kiara mentioned that there have been claims or false advertisements here in terms of what Prevagen is claiming that it will do. And earlier this year, the company settled a nationwide class action lawsuit alleging false advertising. What do you see on the litigation front here on in terms of its advertising?
Yeah, so there were seven open class action lawsuits that were preliminarily settled this July. There was one case in Florida that the lawyers were the lead on the settlement terms there. And basically what it is it's saying that everyone who took Prevagen since 2007 through July of this year had the opportunity, they had a short period of time to file a claim. And if they filed a claim with receipts of Prevagen, they could receive up to $70. If they had no receipts, they could receive up to $12. Now, let me put that in context. If you buy a month's supply of the extra strength Prevagen, which is the grade in the middle because they sell a professional strength and they sell a regular strength, that's going to run you $60. So they're saying at most from this lawsuit, if you have receipts, you can get $70. If you don't have receipts, you get far less than just one bottle of Prevagen. And again, we're talking about people who have memory loss and you're asking them to provide receipts. So I talked to multiple class action lawyers who know this field, and many feel that this settlement was unfair and even told me it was unethical. But the time to apply for a claim is unfortunately over, though the terms of the settlement will be officially settled in November. So we'll have to see whether the judge decides that the terms are fair or not. Otherwise, the FTC, like I mentioned, they filed a claim against Prevagen, Quincy Bioscience, really, the company that makes Prevagen, in 2017. And that's a false advertising suit as well. They filed it along with the New York Attorney General's office, and that suit is still ongoing.
So what's inside the bottle? What are the safety concerns? What about this jellyfish protein?
Yeah, so in the advertising, especially in the early days, the company really leaned on the fact that this was a jellyfish ingredient. And multiple people that I talked to who took Prevagen told me that this was part of the reason why they were attracted to it. They felt like there was something really scientific here, that this was natural because it was a jellyfish ingredient. But actually, the product, the ingredient inside is synthetic. It's made in a lab. It's grown from E. coli bacteria in a fermentation process. And it's not made from actual jellyfish at all. It's a synthetic ingredient. It's an artificial ingredient. And when it was put into Prevagen capsules, that was the first time this synthetic lab-grown ingredient was ever on the market.
Journalist Kiara Eisner has been reporting on the brain health supplement Prevagen. Its makers, Quincy Bioscience, are based in Madison. Do you think the FDA should regulate supplements more, or do you think it's better that they're not highly regulated so consumers have more options? Do you take supplements and believe in their claims? Join in, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Kiara Eisner here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The dietary supplements industry is big business. The market in the U.S. is estimated to be worth $46 billion. We're looking at the brain function supplement Prevagen that is at the center of class action lawsuits about false claims and its labeling and what the FDA is doing to take a stand when false claims go too far. What do you consider truth in advertising for supplements? What is a false or misleading claim? What do you want to know about the FDA's oversight of dietary supplements? Join in at 800-642-1234. Journalist Kiara Eisner reported on the brain health supplement Prevagen for Wired, and she stays with us. Kiara, bring in the FDA here because, you know, shouldn't the FDA be stepping in and at least, you know, providing a disclaimer that it can't prove these claims?
Yeah, so the FDA is definitely an important player here. Because this product has a synthetic ingredient, the company had to submit special documentation basically supporting that it was safe before it could hit the market. Now, most supplements don't have to do this. If you don't have a synthetic ingredient, you can just start selling right away. But because this had a synthetic lab-made ingredient that had never been on the market before or in the human diet, they had to submit special documentation. They submitted this documentation late, and basically by the time the FDA responded and said, hey, this product might be adulterated, you don't have permission to sell it, the product had already been on sale since September, and they were responded in December. So 3 months they had already been on sale. And that was the start of the company's relationship with the FDA. For 9 years, the FDA questioned Prevagen's safety, and mostly that happened behind closed doors. So in 2012, after an inspection in 2011, the FDA released a warning letter, which was really the only public indication that consumers had that the FDA had concerns about safety at all. And this happened, they were inspecting the company through 2018.
So very slow, not a lot of transparency there for consumers.
Certainly. I think the transparency issue is a serious one. You know, even in 2018, when the FDA did issue a closeout letter to kind of say that the company had met all of the, had addressed all of the violations adequately that were raised in 2012, that letter wasn't made public. They're supposed to be made public. So there are clear issues here with transparency, for sure.
Let's bring in a call now. Tracy is with us from Trevor. And Tracy, I understand you took Prevagen.
I did. I took Prevagen. It was last year. And when I took it, I started realizing that my nose, the tip of my nose, started feeling tingly and almost like there were bugs on it. And I was like, well, that's weird. And throughout the day, I'm like, I kept hitting it, you know, like hitting my nose, going, why does it feel like that? And so I was taking Prevagen. I'm in my, you know, lower 50s and for memory. And honestly, what did attract me was a little bit of the that ingredient. My gosh, my mind just went blank.
The jellyfish protein?
The jellyfish, yes. Mm. The jellyfish. That did. I started thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe they found something in that, just like you had said. And so I eventually stopped taking it because it was happening every single day. And then I, after a while, a couple of months went by, I'm like, well, maybe it was just something else. So I'll try it again to redo it. And sure enough, it happened again. And that's when I stopped using it.
Oh, wow. Wow. Kiara, what do you say to this? I mean, look at that side effect.
Yeah, so this is really common. I mean, the FDA has over 4,000 records of adverse events that were submitted by different people who took Prevagen. Some of these were really serious, and there were dozens of serious adverse events that the company knew about and did not report to the FDA. Now, that is a violation. It's a very serious one. We're talking about reports of seizures, of mini strokes, of raised blood pressure. To be considered serious, somebody had to have basically a disability result from their illness or have to have been hospitalized. There are a couple of qualifications you have to meet. And again, the law requires that when supplement companies hear of these kind of serious adverse events, that they report them to the FDA. And time after time, the FDA found that though the company was receiving these reports from consumers, they were not telling the FDA about them. So I'm not surprised to hear that that unfortunately there were these adverse events because there were thousands that the FDA knows about.
We're talking with journalist Kiara Eisner about her article in Wired on the brain health supplement Prevagen made by a Madison-based bioscience company. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Karen now in Toma. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. I just kind of have a broad opinion here. I feel like vitamins and supplements are over-marketed these days, and that a lot of the things that, you know, you see on the shelves, you don't really research them enough, and you don't know if you truly need them. So I just think that if you think that you need a vitamin or supplement, you should either contact your doctor or a specialist before buying or trying to get a prescription for that kind of thing.
Karen, thank you for that. What do you think of that advice, Kiara? Do your homework, talk to your doctor.
I think that's great advice. Doctors can be a great resource, and you know, they can probably tell you that as much as a supplement company, you know, can try to persuade you that it can do something for your brain, you know, there's no cure for Alzheimer's or dementia, unfortunately. There's no known cure, and they can probably tell you a little bit about the FDA's process and the difference between a supplement and a drug. Drugs are go through heavy clinical trials with the FDA. And I'm not saying that's a perfect process, but it's much more diligent than what supplements go through. Most supplements can hit the market immediately without any kind of proof of safety. So it's up to the companies to report adverse events like the ones we just heard about so that the FDA knows that something's going on. If they don't, then that product can remain on the market and people can continue taking it, none the wiser.
Prevagen is still on the market. Why is that?
Well, you know, I'd say it's making money for the people who are selling it. So you can buy it at CVS, you can buy it at Walgreens, you can buy it at Walmart, you can buy it online. You know, it makes money for the TV networks that run its commercials. There's money to be made off of supplements, and that's my opinion of why it's on the market.
What did the FDA tell you about this? When, you know, I would imagine you tried to get some type of word from them, some type of interview.
Of course, yeah. I spoke to the directors of the Dietary Health Supplement Division, two of them, who served while Prevagen was being investigated by the FDA. And, you know, what they told me was that the FDA really looked into Prevagen and really did a bunch of inspections and took it seriously. And that's true. There were inspection after inspection that showed that there were manufacturing issues, that there were adverse event reporting issues. Ultimately, what I thought was really key was that one of these former directors of the FDA told me that, look, they studied it as much as they could, but ultimately, they couldn't prove to the extent required under the FDA Act that there was a serious danger to consumer hearers. And I think that shows that it's just really difficult to get something off the market, even when there is evidence of safety issues.
It's almost like you have to show an overabundance of proof, even though there are so many consumers who have you know, lodged side effects, you know, Tracy being one of them.
I think that's correct. You do have to reach a very high standard.
What did Prevagen tell you?
So they maintain that they're
or Quincy Bioscience, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They say the advertising has been fair. They say, you know, they deny that that they have been participating in false advertising. And, you know, they say that their product is generally recognized as safe or GRAS. What's interesting about that is that the company did file, you know, generally recognized as safe documentation. Now, that's documentation that's usually filed for food products. Mm-hmm. By doing that, They kind of they do what experts told me was basically participate in a loophole, which gets their product on the market as a food product, and then they can sell it as a supplement. So it's a loophole there. And actually, the documentation that they filed, the GRAS documentation, they eventually withdrew in 2015. But the FDA says that even if you withdraw that kind of documentation, you can still claim it. So they claim it's generally recognized as safe, even though they withdrew their own documentation claiming it was safe.
Kiara, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Kiara Eisner is an investigative reporter at the state newspaper in South Carolina, has reported on the brain health supplement Prevagen for Wired. And we reached out to Quincy Bioscience by email yesterday seeking a statement on Prevagen and did not hear back. Coming up, we talk with an attorney about the impending lawsuits in the wake of the presidential election. ProPublica has a guide to election laws and lawsuits. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans here. As votes in the presidential election continue to be counted, we will report on developments and bring them to you throughout the day, throughout the week. Join us tonight at 8 for an NPR election update special with the latest news from around the country here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also follow developments, including Wisconsin election results, at WPR.org. Right now, we're anticipating a wave of voting-related lawsuits in the wake of the election. The Trump campaign filed suits yesterday that seek to stop the counting of ballots in Michigan and Pennsylvania, contesting outcomes in two battleground states. We're turning to ProPublica's guide to election laws and lawsuits. What do you think about voting litigation and how it could affect the electoral process? It's 800-642-1234. Ian McDougall is a lawyer and contributing reporter at ProPublica. Ian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, dealer's choice where to start here. What have you seen in the aftermath with the litigation as it's coming out here in these hours?
So there are really two things going on. One is there's been a wave of new lawsuits filed really in the last day by the Trump campaign in a variety of states, including Wisconsin, although they said they filed one there. I haven't actually seen it yet. Also in Michigan, Georgia. And then the second thing that's going on is there were more than 300 lawsuits filed prior to the election, mm-hmm. and many of them deal with sort of pandemic-related efforts to make voting safer and Republican opposition to some of them. And so there were a number of those that challenged these buffer periods after the election for when mail-in ballots that were mailed before the election could arrive. And those are still ongoing at the Supreme Court and at lower courts. And so those are sort of being reactivated, for lack of a better word, now as well.
So in this post-election, if you will, litigation, to get the courts to step in, the Trump campaign would need to raise specific legal objections under the Constitution or, under a federal statute that could swing a state in his favor. What is at the core of these suits?
They're a bit all over the place, okay. And really what they're trying to do is seemingly to either stop voting in some fashion by arguing our observers aren't given enough access to, they really want to basically be able to roam around the canvassing rooms and look at ballots as much as they want, which judges have rejected before.
So stopping counting is what you're saying. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So until they can basically flood these rooms with their observers. The other thing is, they're trying to get in Wisconsin, I think, a recount, which is technically close enough within the one percentage point margin. But if you talk to people who study this stuff, they'll say, challenges to ballots, recounts, especially at the margins that currently exist in Wisconsin, they very, very rarely succeed in changing the outcome of an election.
So how, did the courtroom battles prior to Election Day affect what we're seeing after Election Day, or is there very little correlation in the themes you're seeing of this litigation?
They are different in the sense that the state or the lawsuits that are being filed now in the various states are really under, for the most part, under various state laws that are in place for things like recounts or challenging ballots, things that you really couldn't raise, before the election. The pre-election stuff was really much more focused on these kinds of various sorts of constitutional challenges, which have more or less merit, aimed at saying things like, this county is doing things different than this other county, and so that therefore is not, uniformity in election practice across the state, or saying things like there's this novel theory that only the state legislatures can set election rules, and so any state court or state executive branch officer that gets involved is illegitimate somehow. And those have actually started to get a little bit of traction, but those are the kinds of arguments that have been raised. There are others as well under statutes, but those are sort of distinct from the ones that are coming out now.
Well, yeah, uniformity in how we vote is not exactly our strong suit. I mean, it just varies straight across the country.
Yep. Yeah, and even within within states, there's the that most election codes say, they set a set of rules, but then they leave a lot of discretion for local conditions, for, each county to kind of figure out how best to fill in the gaps in that election code on their own.
We're talking with Ian McDougall, who's a contributing reporter at ProPublica. His latest piece looks at the states and laws that may determine the outcome and what litigation is on the horizon. How do you feel about the election lawsuits coming out after Election Day? Do you think it's fair? Should there be a recount? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ian, I'm following pretty closely this district judge in Washington, D.C. on the post office sweeps and what is being asked there in searching these, 27 facilities in several swing states for outstanding ballots and to get compliance from the Postmaster General. What is going on there?
Sure. I'll say I haven't followed that one as closely, but from what I understand, that judge is very fond of headline grabbing orders, but also it is troubling that you see a lot of ballots not making it to election officials on time that were mailed before the election. On the other hand, I think there's been a lot of assumptions being made about this being unique, and I just don't know how this compares to past elections. I know there's often are often issues with. For example, the post office sent out, postal service sent out letters earlier this year, which I think they do every year or every election, saying to the state, saying, your sort of rules currently make it, run the risk that things won't get delivered on time. So I know that tension exists every election. I just don't know how much worse the numbers are this year versus prior years, and whether that's just because. There are many more mail-in ballots sent this year versus these sort of the more untoward theories out there about what's been going on. So, a lot of questions there still.
Let's head all the way back to 2000 and the U.S. Supreme Court deciding the outcome of the 2000 election. And seeking those manual recounts. What can we learn there from what happened? With Al Gore.
I think there are two things. I mean, one is should make people fairly confident that, well, I shouldn't say confident, but should make people think that probably isn't going to happen again. You'd really need a situation where it comes down to one or two states that have really, really fine margins. I mean, I think in Florida, it was something like 500 votes.
537.
537, out of whatever, millions and millions. I don't know where ballots are still being counted, but right now it doesn't seem like that's especially likely to happen, but it certainly could. But you really need that kind of a very particular kind of situation for it to come down to a lawsuit like that. And there you had, it was really about, I'll spare you the details, but it had a lot to do with sort of the way that the local courts were ordering recounts. And it was a very particular set of circumstances that could happen again, but doesn't seem particularly likely. The other lesson is, a lot of it, a lot of that was driven, I think, by kind of who controlled the media narrative. So you saw the Bush campaign quite impressively got out ahead. And when Gore and Lieberman were challenging the results, they called them sore loser men. That was sort of they controlled this media narrative about that, you know, that Gore was just, you know, upset about losing, and this was all sour grapes. And, you know, I think both the Democrats and Republicans internalized that, and you kind of see, I think, some of the lawsuits coming out now may be the Trump campaign trying to get control of the media narrative, which seems to be going towards or away from them, I should say.
Well, one law professor I was reading about called the suits a tweet with a filing fee. So that might be one way to look at that. But you know, just more seriously here, is this about finding sympathetic judges to really take your case to heart and finding, you know, a judge who perhaps has your bent, and a conservative judge?
That may be their hope, but so far, actually, as that same professor said, you know, so far, judges, conservative and liberal, have been very good about saying, okay, you say, for example, there's fraud here, or, you know, wrongdoing is going on here. Let's see the evidence. The campaign has often had either no evidence or has had sort of, you know, the equivalent of the Zapruder film from the JFK assassination, saying, look at this, you know, this shadow here. Show that. And the judges have said, come on, give me a break. And so I don't see, foresee a situation where you'd have a judge who would sort of, you know, sign off on just sort of a evidenceless claim of wrongdoing or fraud. Though they may hope they'll find that. The other problem they probably have is that, you know, a lot of the states where they're filing these lawsuits, the state Supreme Courts are not exactly tilted in their favor. That's not true in Georgia, but I think in all the other states it is, more or less. Wisconsin is a little bit of an interesting one, because it's technically a conservative majority, but it's I think two of those justices often go in different directions. So it's not a situation where they could rely on, you know, friendly judges to throw the election to them. Although they may hope that, I'm not sure.
And certainly they can then contest. They can, you know, contest the results and then maybe find another court, another judge that can look at it in a different way. Is that an issue?
Judges generally hate that. It's what they call forum shopping. They might try that, and they are kind of trying that. I mean, some of these claims they've made about observers not getting access have been thrown out by judges in Nevada and other places, saying, "Look, we're not going to let you just roam around, you know, the canvassing halls. Looking, you know, you're going to slow everything down. Social distancing is an issue." But they're trying those kinds of arguments again. I don't see any sign that they're more likely to succeed this time than last time, because these are really, I mean, these are arguments that are just not, they're a bit out there, put it that way.
Attorney Ian McDougall writes, ProPublica's Guide to 2020 Election Laws and Lawsuits. We're asking what happens when election lawsuits start mounting. What do you think about the way candidates responded to the results as the states have tallied votes? How did you observe the results of this election year? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ian McDougall here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation with attorney Ian McDougall. He wrote ProPublica's Guide to Election Laws and Lawsuits. According to a Frontline analysis tracking lawsuits, there have been more than 400 election-related cases filed in the U.S. by political parties, campaign committees, activists, and individual voters this year. Let's bring in a call now. Dave is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Dave. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. All this talk about eliminating the Electoral College is foolish, because the system works, and it's working now. And I'm really proud of every American citizen in this country that got out to vote. If the Electoral College was eliminated, you'd have like California and New York deciding what everybody else does in the middle. And that is just a recipe for disaster. The popular vote is what brought on Adolf Hitler in Germany. And people are getting so divided now And people on the West Coast, East Coast, they just don't understand the middle. And in my own family, three sons, we're all different, and the whole country is different, but that's what makes us great.
Well, Dave, I want to pause there and bring in Ian here. Are there lawsuits that are putting the Electoral College at risk, at jeopardy?
No. That's in the Constitution. So you'd have to have a constitutional amendment to change that, which would require, I think it's 3/4 of the state's approval and also supermajorities of both houses of Congress. I don't think there's any risk of that changing anytime soon.
Well, in looking at the challenges to election results, what are the different ways to challenge an election, like election contests or protests versus a recount?
Yeah, there are really two main ways at the state level. One is the protest, which typically means saying, you know, some set of ballots or some, you know, were flawed or in some way or some precinct did something the wrong way, either by error or fraud. But you need to really prove that. So you can't just say, you know, I think something is wrong here. You have to have real evidence of it, which is where a lot of the lawsuits this election cycle have fallen short. The recount is, there's sort of two kinds. One is if it's within a certain margin, a lot of states, there will be an automatic recount.
Mm-hmm.
In other instances, the parties may ask for them, but they usually has to be within, like I think in Wisconsin, it has to be within 1 percentage point, and the party asking for it has to pay for it unless it's within 0.25% difference.
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, and that varies state by state, but for a recount to happen, the election has to be really close. And even so, it almost never changes the outcome. And even in Florida and the Bush versus Gore situation, I think the prevailing view is that, you know, even if the recount had been allowed to go on, Bush would have won still.
Okay, so timeline here, time frame. How long does it take to contest election results? How long do these courtroom battles go on? Because, you know, we know some litigation can go on for years and years.
Yeah, it's a good point. They try to move them pretty fast. I mean, especially with things like, you know, recount and the ballot challenges kind of thing. I mean, on the day of an election, many states have these election courts where you can go into a dedicated court in the county and they'll decide them kind of as you go. But they can sometimes go beyond, you know, the sort of period of the election result being done. If there's some broader, you know, some broader legal issue that needs to be decided or something like that. But typically they do move them pretty quickly. They need to get the election certified by a certain date. So.
And I would imagine, too, as you mentioned earlier, that evidence plays a huge role here. And when your process carries on and those ballots are all counted, you know, it may get harder and harder to get back to your evidence.
Yeah. I mean,
or
well,
might not. Yeah.
You mean in terms of if the count has been finished?
Yeah, or at a particular poll site, or, you know, kind of recreating that evidence might be difficult.
Yeah, it cuts both ways, I think. You're right that, I mean, you have to move quickly. And the lawyers, you know, election lawyers are used to doing that. They move very quickly. And, you know, you see some of that with some of the Trump campaign's litigation trying to, you know, essentially they're asking for things like, you know, when we didn't have enough access to the canvassing place, we want to see all those ballots and review them all, which is potentially a prelude to trying to find technicalities to challenge them on. You usually are not allowed to do that. And, you know, saying we want to be able to watch this, they need to move fast on that because the counts will be over, as you say, in the near future. On the other hand, you know, until the counts are done, sometimes it can be hard to really know whether it's going to make a difference, which is important because, you know, if you want to challenge 300 ballots, but you lost by 10,000 votes, it doesn't really, you know, and I'm not really sure what the point is. But the other thing is, you know, I think certain, you know, if there were certain irregularities or issues like that, you may not see them until, you know, a particular precinct is fully counted or things like that.
We're talking with Ian McDougall, contributing reporter at ProPublica's latest piece looks at states and laws that may determine the outcome, election lawsuits that he's watching. You can join in with your questions about the suits you're watching post-election day, 800-642-1234. Ian, I keep thinking, like, just with this flood of litigation, what is being pushed aside? What isn't being heard? Because now we have this flood of voting-related, election-related lawsuits.
That's a good question. I mean, I think there's still there are a few enough of them that they're probably not seriously disrupting the dockets of these courts. But yeah, if you had, you know, if you started filing dozens of them, and the courts have to set aside everything else and move quickly, yeah, that puts off, you know, hearing dates for criminal cases where someone might be waiting in jail for a trial or a hearing or something, puts off civil cases. I mean, it certainly at a certain point it could become disruptive. In fairness, I don't think that's happened yet, or I haven't seen evidence of it. But you're right; it could if it really kind of gets out of hand, that certainly is possible.
Okay, so what lawsuits in particular are you watching at this moment?
I think the ones that are most interesting because they have probably the highest chance of success, although I don't know exactly how high, are the ones that are pending either at the Supreme Court or could come back to them soon. So that is, Wisconsin was already decided more or less by the court that they put a block on that sort of post-election buffer period for mail-in ballots to arrive, but they haven't ruled or just even decided whether they're going to rule in a similar case in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. And it doesn't look right now like those are, again, just the ballots that arrive after the election day. And there usually aren't that many of them. And it doesn't sound like there are that many of them this year. And so if those aren't, you know, dispositive, then those cases aren't as important. However, what is really important is there are now four justices that have kind of gotten behind this new theory that, you know, state legislatures alone control election administration. And so, you know, the state constitution can't apply to them because the state Supreme Court couldn't ever overturn them. Governor couldn't veto election administration laws because it's just the legislature that the constitution assigns to control those things. If that becomes the prevailing view, so actually it came up in Bush versus Gore. There was a concurrence by Chief Justice Rehnquist about it. If that becomes the law, and it has already led to one ruling in a federal appeals court, that would have some very serious long-term implications for election administration. It could be people who study this stuff say quite destabilizing because you'd have, you know, you have to do one thing for election laws for federal elections, another for state elections.
Oh, goodness.
You know, for 200 years, legislatures have been assuming they're operating like normal lawmaking bodies where the governor can veto their laws and they're subject to the Constitution. Now, suddenly, that was all wrong. It would be very hard to figure out what the contours of that are, and it could be quite disruptive. But, you know, we may, even if not this election, we may in the near term see that become the law of the land by way of the Supreme Court. And that sort of first become a possibility with these cases that are still pending before the court. So I'm very interested to see where that goes.
Ian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ian McDougall is a lawyer and contributing reporter at ProPublica. Just ahead, we continue our coverage of the election with an Emory University political scientist in Atlanta giving her take on the fate of Georgia's 16 electoral votes and what may play out in the remaining swing states that remain, you know, in a toss-up. How do you think the 2020 election is unfolding? What would you like to say? It's 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.